how corporate boards work and what to do when you want them out, but they won't go. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, March 24th. Glad you could join us this evening. Now, at most companies, the CEO may be in charge day to day, but the buck is supposed to stop with the board. If you want to force change at a company, that is a good place to start. Or at least that's the thinking of a hedge fund called Starboard, which owns a nearly 2% stake in Yahoo and wants to replace that company's entire board of directors. But how do you do that? And what if they don't want to go? For example, Valeant Pharmaceuticals recently asked a member of its board to step down, and he, let's just say, he declined. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at the mechanics of corporate boards.
The board of directors may be the boss of the CEO and management, but boards have bosses too. Actually, lots of bosses.
The board reports to the shareholders of the organization.
Josh Christ is a managing director of Chris Colder Associates, which does maybe 20 to 30 board placements a year.
Board members can be replaced by those shareholders.
There are a number of different ways that you can replace a board member.
Cindy Scapani is a business law professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
One may be the CEO has a private meeting and asks the member to resign.
You know, try and get them to go quietly. Or if their term is up, just don't nominate them to serve again. But if it's a shareholder who wants to make the change, they might go for something called a proxy fight, putting it to a shareholder vote.
You can vote either for management's nominees or you can vote for some insurgents' nominees.
John Coffey, a law professor at Columbia, says these proxy fights used to be rare. So-called activist investors, often hedge funds, are making them more common. But they are not easy or cheap.
That's really a kind of miniature political campaign.
You've got to track down a list of shareholders, which you might have to sue the company for. You've got to mail them all info on your new candidates, try and get them to vote your way, follow up with phone calls.
Most shareholders are not going to read this long, complicated proxy statement. That's why you're going to depend more on fight letters, newspaper ads, and the work of the proxy solicitors. These are well-known financial firms that specialize in representing one side or the other in proxy contests.
Coffey says proxy fights can cost several million dollars, sometimes more. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
U.S. taxpayers spend roughly $30 billion a year to help send low-income students to college through the federal Pell Grant program, and many billions more in subsidized loans. But only half of those students actually finish college within 6 years. Today, the Obama administration released a new report shining a spotlight on colleges that are doing a better job in hopes that those who aren't will be prodded into changing their ways. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
Just over a decade ago, low-income students at Georgia State University graduated at barely half the rate of other students. Today, that gap is closed, thanks to more intensive advising and small grants to cover emergencies. A program at City University of New York nearly doubled completion rates for community college students by giving them more academic support.
And so we want to lift up those examples so that they can be replicated by other institutions.
That's Education Secretary John King. His department's report does not call out colleges by name that are doing a poor job, though it does flag the Ivy League for not admitting more low-income students. At some schools, fewer than 1 in 10 receive Pell Grants. Still, says Tom Sugar with Complete College America, the report is a start.
I think it's a good sign that the federal government is beginning to pay attention to something that has been too long ignored.
He says Pell graduation rates matter, and not just because taxpayers are spending billions on the program.
It's getting harder and harder to reach or stay in the middle class without some kind of college education.
Lauren Asher is president of the Institute for College Access and Success. She says one big reason so many low-income students don't graduate is the rising cost of college at less than $5,800 a year.
The maximum Pell Grant covers just 29% of what it costs to go to a public four-year college in state. That's a record low.
Most low-income students have to work through college, and many aren't academically prepared. Student advocates say colleges might do a better job of supporting those students if schools were required to report their Pell graduation rates to the government. The Education Department's report relied on data from other sources. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oil tumbles again. Markets not doing much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
I
Over now to Georgia, where the governor, Nathan Deal, has until May 3rd to veto or sign a controversial religious freedom bill, one that critics say will lead to discrimination against gays. Several Georgia-based companies, including Coca-Cola and Delta Airlines, are opposing the bill, ditto for the NFL, which is threatening to withhold a Super Bowl in Atlanta. It turns out Georgia is also popular, though, for TV and film production, and several big media companies, big like Viacom, Disney, Sony, Lionsgate, you get me? They're objecting to the bill and threatening to stop shooting in Georgia if it becomes law. Marketplace's Andy Baxter has more.
The bill is called the Free Exercise Protection Act, and it would allow faith-based groups to decline to hire or give services to people when doing so violates the organization's religious beliefs.
This bill will have a disproportionate impact on the LGBT community.
Sarah Warbelow is legal director for the Human Rights Campaign. She says among the bill's effects, homeless shelters, adoption agencies, and drug counseling programs could say they don't want to serve gay people.
Really, it gives a license for anyone to claim that their religious beliefs should trump the law.
Her group is soliciting help from business interests, including Hollywood, to speak out against the bill. Filming in Georgia brings billions of dollars into the state.
Right now, we have something like 42 shows in production.
Matthew Bernstein teaches film at Emory University in Atlanta. He says Georgia is the number three filming location in the U.S., thanks to the state's entertainment tax credits of up to 30%. Among the big projects filmed there, Captain America Civil War from Disney's Marvel unit. Now Disney is among those threatening to boycott filming in Georgia.
This would have a considerable impact on the state's economy because tax incentives have been so dramatic in building things up.
Jonathan Taplin, a media expert at the University of Southern California, says it would be pretty easy logistically for most media companies to stop scouting in Georgia.
You're not making Gone with the Wind, you know?
In other words, what matters is typically the tax credits, not the Georgia landscape. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
A little more on movies, if you will indulge us. Warner Brothers Studios is banking a lot of its financial future on this week's opening of the long-awaited movie Batman vs. Superman.
The greatest gladiator match in the history of the world. Son of Krypton versus Bat of Gotham.
The city that served as a backdrop for much of that film, Detroit, is also hoping for a bump in popularity from the first big screen pairing of the iconic superheroes. And don't worry if you want to just find where your favorite scene was shot in Detroit. As WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter reports, there's an app for that.
I'm standing in front of a 15-story building at a busy intersection in the heart of downtown Detroit. It's a building I usually do my banking in. So imagine my surprise when commercials show in the Batman vs. Superman movie, it gets blown up. Actually, the bank building still stands. Its destruction was just the magic of movie making. The filmmakers were drawn to Michigan because of tax credits. Batman vs. Superman received $35 million worth of tax breaks on the promise that filmmakers would spend about $130 million in the state. The movie's executive producer, Michigan native Wes Collar, knew there was much more to the Motor City than tax breaks and blight.
In terms of city looks, it's got every look you could imagine. There's tons of just great opportunities to get outside of the city and pick up great landscapes and whatever we may need.
Those locales include the Mixed Snack Shop near that downtown bank building. Co-owner Marina Abdullah says the film's director wanted the store closed one Saturday because Bruce Wayne was going to be hurtling by en route to saving a portion of humanity.
He was telling us what was going to happen, that building, the glass building over there, was going to be destroyed and it was going to be blown up. And we had helicopter scenes and they had a helicopter come down and, oh, it was so exciting.
Tell me, do you bleed? You will.
But it's something that may not happen again. Michigan lawmakers canceled the film tax credit last year, arguing it was only returning about 60 cents on the dollar to the state. Marina Abdullah counters that the Caped Crime Fighters crew brought money into her store and other Detroit businesses.
For us, it was very nice because we had some of the crew that was working on come in and purchase things. And I think it brings a lot of money into the city, and that I think that was a mistake that they did that.
Even without the tax incentives, Michigan still has a film office, and staff there knew Detroit was doubling as Metropolis and Gotham City. Why not leverage that?
Recent studies that show that one in five people travel because of a movie or a TV series that they've been inspired by.
So Michigan Film Commissioner Janelle Leonard has created a new mobile app highlighting locations used in the movie.
With each stop. It provides background information on the actors or the location or a community layer specific to the revitalization of Detroit, things to do, places to go. So it has a couple different layers there.
The locations range from an abandoned train station to Belle Isle, a lush island on the edge of the city. And the lack of tax incentives may not be kryptonite for the Michigan-based movie industry. Director Zack Snyder, for one, says the bat may be back in Detroit because he says they've established the city as the backdrop for the movie, and he's loath to recast the part. In Detroit, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter for Marketplace.
Music is both big business and beloved by many, and for years now, a lot of time, energy, and sophisticated technology has been devoted to figuring out what we, music listeners, want to hear. But while big data may be serving our playlists, it's played a much smaller role in the lives and the livelihoods of the actual musicians. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor reports on why that is and how it's changing.
Maybe you're into Mongolian throat singing. It's not hard to find, and services like Spotify and Pandora can figure out that you like it and help you discover more of it. And they do this using algorithms and big data. It's great for you in Spotify and Pandora. Musicians, though, when it comes to data, they're often in the dark. I'm just saying that it's not a lie. Kevin Devine is a musician who's thought a lot about what music distributors know and musicians don't.
Here are the countries where your music is being streamed most. Here are the cities. Here is the age breakdown. Here's the gender breakdown. Here is five other artists that your listeners are also streaming.
Devine says musicians desperately need this information because basically the old landscape of music distribution has exploded.
There's so much noise, so much clutter, so much streaming at all times.
Jeppe Farfelt is co-founder of a startup called Linkfire. He says someone in Brazil may stream music with Claro Musica. Someone in France uses Deezer. People in the U.S. have a ton of different options.
The fragmentation has opened up the need for more information.
Startups like his are beginning to offer it. Linkfire tracks how users are listening to or buying specific music so musicians can figure out how to connect to them. More established companies like Pandora are also now investing heavily in data products for musicians. Sarah Clemens is chief strategy officer at Pandora.
Being able to understand exactly where their fans are and then knowing that those might be the places that they would tour to and where they would have big audiences in each city is really powerful information for a working musician.
Pandora lets musicians target fans and send them audio messages to promote tours, for example. It also bought Next Big Sound, which keeps tabs on likes and comments and shares on Tumblr and Instagram and Facebook. Kieran Gandhi is a musician who plays under the name Madam Gandhi. And she says the more data, the better.
Being able to say, show things like, this is the moment at which the listener stopped listening to your song and skipped forward. Or this is the moment at which the user increased the volume of your song.
It's a world that will probably be real soon as streaming services look for new ways to make money from their endless spools of data and musicians find new ways to use it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
Now, Sabri is the co-host of the podcast Actuality. It's a joint venture between Marketplace and Quartz, the business news magazine from The Atlantic. And Sabri joins us now. Hi, Sabri.
Hi, Molly.
So season two of the podcast launches today, and I understand that the first episode is all about music and algorithms and big data. What can we look forward to hearing, Sabri?
Yeah, me and my co-host Tim Fernholz, we sort of take a in-depth look at some slice of the global economy each episode. And this season, we're looking at things that people said or thought never could be done. And the first thing we're looking at is actually the outsourcing of culture to robots, to machines. So if you think about it, you know, algorithms on Facebook show us political posts that things we'll like. Amazon recommends books. And we are looking specifically at music. So when algorithms, you know, are determining how tens of millions of people experience music, what does that mean for our culture? And by the way, future episodes, we will be looking at space internet and going inside a nuclear fusion reactor.
And future episodes, I would like to do that too. If you would like to subscribe to Actuality, like I do, you can find it on iTunes or anywhere you like to podcast. Thanks a lot, Sabri.
Thanks, Molly.
Coming up.
Take this wet rag right here to cool it down. It sizzles, kind of like a grill. It's really hot, so I wouldn't touch it. You want to touch it?
Some high school students are taking a hands-on approach to preparing for the job market. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 13 points, less than a tenth percent, to finish at 17,515. The NASDAQ lost 4 points, a tenth percent, to close at 4,773. The S&P 500 was basically flat, ended the day at 2035. Financial stocks faltered. PayPal shed 4%. Prudential Financial fell 2.8%. Morgan Stanley was off 1.3%. And Citigroup was down 1%. Office supply firms Staples and Office Depot both rose on optimism about their planned merger deal. Staples clipped up 7%. Office Depot penned a 9% gain. Signet Jewelers shined up 2.8% after posting strong quarterly results and issuing an annual profit forecast that beat expectations. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.90%. And you're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. The business of the cloud has only been growing in importance in the last few years. Companies like Amazon and Microsoft are making billions of dollars selling services that let companies do business, store files, and access information on networked computers that they maintain, secure, and basically rent out. Google this week announced a big push into cloud services, hoping to grab a larger chunk of the pie. And as competition heats up, some of the cloud pioneers are feeling the pressure. One of those is Box, an enterprise storage company led by CEO Aaron Levy. He's here now. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell me, I feel like most people who are not investors or in the tech industry are just starting to hear a lot more about this exciting new cloud business. I know that seems inconceivable, but it's true.
Yep.
What's the state of the cloud industry right now?
It is funny, the time lag of these kind of things. So we started Box 11 years ago, and the original idea and premise for the company was, as we became, you know, both in our personal lives and in our business lives, more and more mobile, more collaborative, we wanted to work from anywhere. All of these trends lead companies to needing modern technology. And the past 20 to 30 years of enterprise software just isn't working for most enterprises today. And that's sort of the whole solution that we provide, is letting companies become more agile, become more collaborative, be able to move more quickly. And we're fortunate that we've been able to do that to 57,000 customers.
Yeah, earlier this week, actually, in a TechCrunch article, you predicted that the cloud wars are starting. One rumor that we've heard lately is that Apple might actually insource its cloud infrastructure, and that seems like a possibility for other large companies because, as you wrote, the prices are coming down. Is that a concern for you?
Well, I think that the overall trend is that the underlying technology that powers the applications that you and I use, that over time isn't very differentiating to any individual technology vendor. And so the more that Google or Amazon or others compete in this category, the more that those costs get driven down and the more then leverage that we end up getting as a developer on those technologies. So a lot of the moves that you've seen recently and that you'll certainly see over the coming years are going to benefit any service provider that builds on top of those kinds of clouds. And I'm sure after all of this, people are only more confused about how this industry is actually operating.
Kind of, yeah.
just know this, if you're listening, all of your software will get better, faster, cheaper, and more secure. And that's what matters.
Let's talk about more secure.
Sure.
Because I know that's kind of a big issue right now.
It is.
You supported Tim Cook in the sort of battle for the future of encryption. But I have to imagine that security is paramount for you, especially now, right? With your clients?
It is. Absolutely. The only reason that you've seen this kind of adoption of cloud services, whether it's of Box or Salesforce.com or Amazon Web Services, is because we're at a stage where you can get better security, you can get better data encryption, you can get better control of your information in a cloud service than you can in a traditional environment. And so we take encryption very seriously. This is why we came out in favor of Apple and Tim Cook, as this has a very meaningful impact on our industry, and the different kinds of outcomes could absolutely be disastrous for the growth of technology.
With all of this business, with so much information moving into the cloud, at what point does the cloud infrastructure, and we know that there are infrastructure concerns along the pipeline, become a huge target?
Well, I think certainly the way to think about the cloud is it's really the aggregation of a bunch of technology and servers and networks that used to just be spread around at each individual organization that needed to run their own data center, but now done in much more efficient and larger environments. And so it's not so much that the attack surface is any larger or wider, it's just less distributed. So yes, the cloud is definitely an attack target as any network has ever been, but your ability to secure it doesn't become any less possible. In fact, quite the opposite in a lot of cases.
That's Aaron Levy, CEO of Box. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
The proportion of high school students who take classes in, let's say, construction, has gone down over the past couple decades. And at the same time, employers in construction and other industries say they can't find enough skilled workers. But vocational training hasn't gone away completely, and some school districts are really emphasizing it. Plus, it no longer comes with that old stereotype that it's for students who aren't college material. From WABE in Atlanta, Molly Samuel reports.
Jordan Decker is using a torch to melt pieces of metal together, making a little shape to practice his brazing skills.
This is sort of a tree.
He's 17 in the 11th grade.
Take this wet rag right here to cool it down, and it sizzles. Kind of like a grill. It's really hot, so I wouldn't touch it. You want to touch it?
No.
Okay.
Thanks for the offer.
Yeah, no problem.
Decker is learning to work in heating, ventilation, and air conditioning.
Without this program, I'd still be trying to find what I want to do in my life. Like, this is what I want to do.
He's one of more than 1,200 students that are here at the Carroll County College and Career Academy on any given day. It's west of Atlanta, near the Alabama border. Students here learn fields as varied as culinary arts, welding, and auto mechanics. They all go to one of the 5 regular high schools in the district for their other classes, like math and history, then come here for job skills. Most high schools offer some kind of career training, but a lot of that is focused on things like healthcare or communications. Decker's teacher, Steve McRae, says vocational training has changed.
I think it used to be kind of, a dumping ground for troubled kids, and now it's for kids that want to go out there and they want to get a job.
And they'll probably continue with their educations after high school, too. Bob Schwartz is at the Harvard Graduate School of Education.
You know, in the old days, it was some kids are going to college and some kids are going to work and you need to treat them differently. And I think we now are beginning to understand everybody needs something beyond a high school education and everybody needs to be thinking from pretty early on about a career.
Several years ago, Schwartz and a couple of colleagues did a study on how prepared young people in America were to join the workforce. They found, on the one hand, even though high schools have encouraged students to pursue college degrees, plenty of students never get that far. They end up without degrees or much career direction. And on the other hand,
from the employer perspective, they're saying the skills gap is real. We simply can't find people with the skills we need to be able to grow our businesses.
He says lots of high school dropouts later say one reason they didn't stick with it was they didn't see how what they were learning applied to the real world. In the last couple of decades, the percentage of students taking classes in construction, manufacturing, and other trades has gone down. Meanwhile, job prospects for people who do have those skills are good. Take heating, ventilation, and air conditioning installation and repair. That's what student Jordan Decker is studying. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that field will grow 14% by 2024, adding nearly 40,000 jobs. In Georgia, there are more than 300 openings every year, both new jobs and unfilled positions.
I plan on getting a job doing this out of high school and then eventually going to college and working for their big company and making it bigger myself.
The county revamped its technical education program in 2005. Since then, the school has doubled its enrollment, and the principal says a lot of that increase has been from the more academically accomplished students deciding to come here. In 2015, more than 90% of the seniors who took classes here graduated from high school. The school system's average that year was 76%. Teacher Steve McRae says he enjoys hearing from his former students.
You know, it's nice when they stop back and they tell you, oh, Mr. McCray, look at my new truck. You know, look, I'm buying my house.
At the end of the class, the students clock out with their time cards. That's how McCray, some of them call him Coach, takes attendance.
See you, Coach. Thanks,
in Carroll County, Georgia, I'm Molly Samuel for Marketplace.
And And this final note before we go, word today that one of the pioneers of time-shifted TV recording, TiVo, is close to a deal to sell itself to a company called Rovi. I know you may be thinking that these are two companies you've barely heard of or don't care about. TiVo makes a great DVR with a great interface and tiny market share. Rovi makes an interactive TV guide that maybe about 18 million people use. But between them, they would own about 6,000 patents related to recording and playing back live television and to streaming over-the-top video, both areas that I think you've probably heard are becoming kind of a big deal. And that's it. We have got to go. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I am Molly Wood. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.